The Guardian.
The film you are about to see, Hospital, is an unflinchingly honest portrait of what goes on in a large city hospital devoted to helping the people in the area. Filmed over a period of 5 weeks, it shows what actually takes place in the emergency room, operating room, the receiving rooms, wards, and clinics. Some of the scenes and a few words may make you uncomfortable, but to delete them would distort the reality of this unusual documentary.
A very cautious preamble there to the 1970 Fred Wiseman documentary titled Hospital. We then go on to see the opening image of the film. It is that of a woman, prostrate on an operating table. Her arms are out, cruciform-like. And what unfolds is a montage of images, stark, black and white, of an operation and its sterile surroundings being prepared by the medical staff. Finally, we see the surgeon take his scalpel and cut. Hello, I'm Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps. Welcome to a special edition of the show dedicated to one of America's greatest documentary filmmakers. Critic and writer Agnès Poirier met with Frederick Wiseman in Paris this spring to discuss his latest documentary, Boxing Gym.
Two great books about film editing. One is Flaubert's Letters to George Sand, and the other is UNESCO's Essays about Playwriting. Those are the two best books I've ever read about film editing.
But also she spoke to him to gain some insight into his work as a filmmaker and how his distinct cinematic philosophy evolved. Wiseman is best known for his social documentaries, largely looking at institutions. His directorial debut, Titicut Follies, not only marked Wiseman out as a distinct filmmaker with a very particular stylistic approach to social documentary, it was politically explosive, taking as its subject the treatment of inmates at Bridgewater State Hospital for the criminally insane in Massachusetts. The film was for some time banned, and it took a huge effort for Wiseman to untangle his work from state censorship. It remains the only film ever banned in the US for reasons other than the obscenity laws, and it triggered massive social reform in the healthcare sector in America. Unlike other US documentary filmmakers, such as Errol Morris or Michael Moore, Wiseman's films garner more critical acclaim than box office success. To quote the cliché, Wiseman is a filmmaker's filmmaker. And I recall on many occasions here on Film Weekly, when we interview leading American directors, his name was mentioned as a key influence. And oddly, more often than not, these directors worked in fiction, not documentary. I recall one particular incident when the young filmmaker Kerry Fukunaga told Jason Solomons and I how he and a group of his cinephile friends in New York sought out Wiseman's films and exchanged them like precious objects. Agnès Poirier's conversation with the influential Frederick Wiseman was in the context of a screening of his latest film, Boxing Gym, and so their discussion of his work circled around what Wiseman admitted to be his preoccupation in many of his films with violence, both intimate and institutional.
I used to go to the movies a lot when I was very young. My parents, there was a theater about a 6-7 minute tramway ride from my house. And my parents, from a very early age, let me go to the movies on Saturday afternoon with my friends. And in addition to seeing a feature film, we were always, you know, it was before television. So March of Time was very important. So, I remember the newsreels from the 30s and my, you know, awareness of other things that were going on in the world from watching the March of Time newsreels. And I like movies a lot. And my father also, my father was a lawyer, and I used to meet him for lunch downtown on Saturdays. And he would take me to a club that he belonged to called the City Club, where they showed movies on Saturday afternoon for the children of the members. And we used to have lunch together, and I used to meet all the lawyers that he knew and the politicians that ate there, and we went to the movies and went home. So, I mean, I went to the movies a lot as a child, and I, you know, and I still think some of my favorite movies are movies that I saw then, like W.C. Fields and the Marx Brothers and...
Any other films that caught your imagination perhaps a bit later when you were more, I don't know, politically aware?
I mean, you're suggesting that the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields don't have intellectual substance?
They do. I was fed on them. Just thinking about perhaps a bit later, of course, the Marx Brothers are philosophy in themselves.
I mean, the film about Fredonia, I mean, is one of the best, you know, all political science students should study it.
You can leave in a taxi. If you can't get a taxi, you can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, you can leave in a minute and a huff. You know, you haven't stopped talking since I came here. You must have been vaccinated with a phonograph needle.
The future of Fredonia rests on you. Promise me you'll follow in the footsteps of my husband.
How do you like that? I haven't been on the job 5 minutes and already she's making advances to me. Not that I care, but where is your husband?
Why?
Don't fool me. I know I gotta keep moving. Man, I got so much to do. If I want the peace, I got a lot of work to do. Listen, gotta get that peace. I need it. Then I can get things moving again. We'll become a fighting gang again, like in the olden days. I don't care what anyone else says. The bopping days ain't over. Lots of guys still swinging. Yeah. And then one day, I'll come walking down this street. Everyone will look at me with respect and say, there goes Duke Custis. He's a cold killer.
So, I had the idea, a novel by Warren Miller called A Cool World could make an interesting movie because it was about black kids in Harlem. And at that point, that was a subject that was not hadn't really been dealt with in film. And because I had no experience in movies, I didn't direct it myself, but I approached someone else to direct it, and I produced it. And I learned a great deal that way about what to do and what not to do in making a movie. And I, as a result of that experience, as I think I said to you a moment ago, it demystified the process. And so I thought that I then knew enough to try and make a movie of my own. And I was always more interested in documentary than fiction. My interest in documentary took specific form in this, was just a few years after the technological developments that made it possible to shoot synchronous sound documentaries on any subject. I mean, somebody figured how to control, run the camera and the tape recorder at the same speed. So that means you could make a movie about any subject you wanted as long as there was available light. I mean, you could light it too if you wanted, but available light and gave you great flexibility, as did the fact that you didn't no longer needed to have the camera and the tape recorder attached to each other. So, in order to overcome part of my boredom as a law teacher, I took students in a course in legal medicine to visit the kind of places where their clients might end up if they didn't represent them well. So I took them to prisons and parole board hearings and criminal trials and mental hospitals. And one of the places I took them to was the Bridgewater State Prison for the Criminally Insane. And so when I decided when I'd had the experience working on this half documentary, half fiction film, and decided I wanted to not teach law anymore, but wanted to make documentaries, it occurred to me that Bridgewater might make a good documentary. So, and I knew the superintendent from my visits there with students. So I approached him and he liked the idea and helped me with the politics of getting permission, which took a long time. It took a year and a half. And I finally got permission, and The film was shot, and then I edited it, and then the state of Massachusetts, it was a long, complicated struggle around the Follies, which so it was banned. I don't know whether you want me to, that's a long story. I don't have to go into that, unless you want me to.
Well, Vladimir, as I promised you before, if I see enough improvement in you...
But how can I improve if I'm getting worse? I'm trying to tell you, day by day, I am getting worse because of the circumstances, because of the situation. Now, you tell me, until you see an improvement, each time I get worse. So, obviously, it's the treatment that I'm getting, or the situation, or the place, or the patients, or the inmates. Well, I do not know which. Well, I want this to go back to the person where I belong. I was supposed to only come down here for observation. What observation did I get? You call me up a couple of times, you say, well, take some medication for the mind. I'm supposed to take medication for if I have some bodily injury, not for the mind. My mind is perfect.
It's another way of teaching, I guess. I mean, you're perhaps demystifying an institution for a wider public. Because an institution, by definition, can be quite daunting or intimidating.
Well, it's in my view, it's a variety of things. Certainly, one aspect of it is teaching. But teaching implies a certain degree of didacticism, which I try to reject in the films. I like to think of the films, as dramatic structures with a beginning and a middle and an end, even though the so-called story is not told in a traditional way, but is told in a more abstract form. The analogy for me is writing, because the editing of one of these movies is a lot like writing. The relationship of fact to imagination is different, because presumably a writer, a novelist, is limited only by the interplay between his imagination and the facts of his experience, while I'm limited by the way my imagination plays against the facts of the rushes that I accumulate. But nevertheless, that I have a very wide range of choice, not as wide, but within that range of choice, the issues are very similar. Issues of characterization, passage of time, metaphor, abstraction, rhythm. How do you tell? Instead of telling a story in the images of words, you tell a story in the images of pictures. I think I've been more influenced by writers than I have been by filmmakers, because I'm more conscious of the relationship between what I do in the editing and what I read. There are two great books about film editing. One is Flaubert's Letters to George Sand, and the other is UNESCO's Essays about Playwriting. Those are the two best books I've ever read about film editing.
To start is by looking at one of the best of the poems, The Dangling Conversation. That's the first one on your sheet. And the process we'll use, first we'll read the poem, then listen to it. Then we'll talk about it and see how all the various poetic devices reinforce the theme, see what you think about it, and then we'll listen to it once again, and I'll bet it means something a little bit more to you.
If I door ain't open wide,
if the door ain't open wide,
I got my rifle by my side.
As a documentary filmmaker today, one assumes that there are many other very difficult subjects you'd like to tackle, which seem to be like impossible missions. I don't know, like the American Army and.
The movies that I'd like to do, I'm not going to tell you what they are. Because, I never like to talk about that for perhaps paranoid or perhaps good judgment reasons. But I made three movies about the American Army. And in each case, I've had absolutely no difficulty in dealing with the Pentagon. They've been extremely receptive and cordial and asserted no control over the movie. I mean, in Missile, which is a movie about the training of crews that launch intercontinental nuclear missiles, I had to agree, and which I readily agreed, that I would show it at the Pentagon to make sure that there were no launch codes in the movie. Now, I knew if there were launch codes in the movie that I'd have a lot of new friends, and so I had no trouble showing it to the Pentagon before it was released. In fact, they made no request for any changes at all. I mean, and I thought that was a, you know, perfectly reasonable request. But then I made one on Army basic training during the Vietnam War, and I made one on war games in West Germany. And in each case, it was, I had no problem getting permission and no problem with the film. My great secret, which I'll confide to you for the first time I've ever told anybody, is that I ask for permission.
Je suis sûr, Vitya, que cette lettre te parviendra. Bien que je sois derrière la ligne du front et derrière les barbelés du ghetto juif, je ne recevrai pas ta réponse.
The last letter, was there any reason why you did it in French?
I got the money.
Is that the only reason?
Well, no, it's not the only reason. I did the play in France originally at the Comédie Française. I wanted to use Catherine Samy, who was in the played the role of the mother in the play. I wanted her to have the role in the movie. She doesn't. I mean, she speaks English, but not well enough to do the play or the movie in English. And because the play was well received here, I was able to get the support of the French subsidy system.
So it's not entirely pragmatic reason.
No, it wasn't pragmatic. I mean, I didn't think of actually doing English. I didn't think of doing it, the movie, with anyone other than Catherine.
Because it seems to be a sort of, not a one-off, but slightly different from your other films, in the sense that it's, how would you describe it?
I mean, how would I describe it? It's a movie based on a chapter of a great Russian novel by Vasily Grossman. Everybody should read the novel. It's one of the great novels of all time, in my view. But the novel's called Life and Fate. And I took, I think it's a chapter of 14 pages. And it's a chapter where a Russian Jewish woman doctor who's living in a small town in the Ukraine, recently occupied and seized by the Germans at the beginning of the war, writes a last letter to her son because she knows that she's going to be killed in a few days. In thematic terms, it's closely related to my other movies because, I mean, I didn't consciously set out to have human violence as one of the themes of my movies, as I didn't consciously set out to make a lot of movies. You know, I just made one after the other. But in retrospect, and I think it's probably unavoidable when you're making movies about people, violence is a theme that emerges. So the last letter is related, in my mind, to a whole group of movies that I've made. To Tittycat Follies. Tittycat Follies is a movie that but people who have committed the worst crimes imaginable. The three military movies, Missile, Maneuver, and Basic Training, are again examples of the state having a monopoly on certain forms of violence in order to protect its citizens. So that in that abstract sense, it's very related to the other films. Technically, not at all.
Et up, et up, et up, et up. Il y a quand même plus de 300 000 spectateurs. C'est une compagnie qui est réputée pour comme étant la meilleure du monde. On est quand même, disons, une des meilleures du monde. Et tout ça, c'est pas par hasard que ça se fait.
Slip. Faster.
So you can only come here during the classes?
No, you come here any time of day you want. Yeah. $50 a month. Anytime you want. No contracts, no initiation fees, no plastic.
Okay.
And that's it. And you just come here and open all day long.
Sounds like a square deal.
And whatever day you want to start on, that's the first of the month for you.
Come on, 5 seconds, go. There you go. Come on.
Come on. Ah! Ow! I mean, when I saw the film this morning, Boxing, I thought about Gene Kelly. I mean,
I like your association.
But there's something about dance.
Well, it's a movie. I mean, it's as much about dance as it is about boxing, because there obviously is some similarities. In La Danse, Brigitte Lefebvre, who's the head of the Paris Opera Ballet, says to someone who's talking to her, the dancer is half nun and half boxer. So it's a nice connection, and there are obvious similarities in that both dancers and boxers have to have a complete control over their bodies and their arm movements, their leg movements, their head movements. The boxing gym was actually shot before La Danse, but I stopped editing it in order to shoot and edit La Danse, and then finished it after I'd finished editing La Danse.
I mean, they are very endearing characters, the Mr. Lord and this, and the boxing gym. I mean, I hear some of my fellow critics at the end of the screening this morning, and they say, oh, I want to take up boxing.
Good.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, I mean, I liked Richard Lord a lot. I liked him the moment I met him, as soon as I walked into his gym, when I saw this sign outside that said Lord's Gym, I knew I was in the right place. And also, as soon as I walked in, it's like being handed a $20 million set, because you have to be a brilliant set designer to design that for a fiction movie. And so I was able to use it or take advantage of it. And Richard and I hit it off is perhaps the wrong choice of words, got along very well from the beginning, and he agreed right away to give me permission to do the film.
And did you try boxing? I mean, did he give you a few lessons?
Yeah, because I was too busy making the movie, but I had boxed a little bit when I was 13.
Are you planning on doing any other sports scrutinizing documentaries?
Not at the moment, but you never know.
Is there a question I didn't ask you would have liked to answer?
Covered the waterfront, so to speak.
I think we have.
Agnès Poirier, film writer and critic, in conversation with Frederick Wiseman. Boxing Gym is on release in France and as soon as we hear of a UK release, we will let you know. But for more information on Frederick Wiseman's films, go to zipora.com. That's zipporah.com. But for now, from Agnes Poirier and Film Weekly producer, that's me, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.